Today is November the 16th, 1991, and the following is an interview by telephone between Margaret Visiger and her parents, Martha and Frank Visiger. This will be side one of tape one. Margaret is conducting the interview from Kodiak by telephone, and we're taping this telephone conversation in Springfield, Oregon. Okay, go ahead, Margaret.
Okay. Mom, I'm going to address my questions to you first, and then I'll interview Dad. But, you know, we watched an Alaska history film the other day, and the woman who narrated it said she was born in Alaska in 1906, and she was one of the first women pilots, and her name was Mary Nell, possibly Mary Nell Santa Croce. Have you ever heard of her?
No, I can't say that I have, Margaret.
Well, we were trying to figure out if this was fictional or real. It was almost a possibility that it was fictional. You know, she was a fictional character. And I just was wondering, do you have a heard of her?
No, I haven't. Of course, it would depend on what part of Alaska she was from.
Yeah, I don't think it was Southeast. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, I'm going to conduct this kind of as a kind of a family history, your history and also a family history. Tell me a little bit about Grandpa. First of all, I don't know his middle and name, and would you tell me where he was born and when he was born, and kind of, you know, how he got over to the United States and got involved in coal mining, that type of thing.
Well, my father, Evan Jones, did not have a middle name. I don't know why. Oh. His name was Evan Jones, and he was born in Aberdare, Wales, in 1880, and he lived there. He lived in Wales. I'm not too sure of all my dates on this, but he was probably 12, I think, when he first went into a coal mine, but only as a trapper boy, a boy that lifted, opened and closed the doors so they could take the coal through, but they had to keep the doors closed because of the ventilation. And then he had a stepmother. He wasn't very happy with her, so he left home and emigrated to the United States. And that would probably be in about 1895, I imagine.
Okay, 1895. Did he start working in coal mines, though, in Canada then? Is that where he learned his mining skills, or did he attend like a mining school, or how did he become, you know so much about mining?
Yes. Lots of this, of course, I have to get from notes my mother left or anything. But she was in Canada, and he was there. He was probably about 20 years old, and she was about 13. The families, their family knew my dad. And she said that he started a correspondence course with the Bureau of Mines in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he became a fire boss, which means a man in charge of the dynamiting, and then seeing that all the shots had gone off and all the air was clear and the men could come in again. Let's see, that was at Frank, Alberta. I know he was doing that then. And they served rather an apprenticeship in those days. They went from one job to another, gradually up to the scale where they could be a superintendent of mines, which was what he was, or the equivalent of a mining engineer.
Okay, so was he working, he worked in Canada and then also in the United States?
Yes.
South of the U.S.
Right, lots of places in the United States. Iowa, Missouri, of course, around Ravensdale. Mines there. There are a lot of mines around Ravensdale, Wilkeson, that country.
Okay. When was Grandma born?
Grandma was born in 1887 in Iowa.
What was her middle name?
Her middle name was Bronwyn Morgan. I don't think she had a middle name either, Margaret.
Interesting, because I've never heard it either.
No, I haven't either. And, you know, usually Welsh people are very fond of names.
Yeah,
But for some reason, she wasn't. She didn't have a middle name. No, it was Bronwyn Morgan.
Was she Welsh also?
She was part Welsh and part English.
Were her parents coal miners?
Now, her father was born in Tregaregar, Wales, and he emigrated to the United States first. His family settled in Iowa, and he had majored in music, a music school in Wales, and he was actually a music teacher. He always led the choirs in church, and then when that didn't pay enough, he worked on the mine, in a mine on the side. So that's how my mother met my dad. Was actually, he was conducting this church choir, and my father sang in the choir because he had a good voice. That was probably, I think, when mother was about 13 and dad was about 20, because there were 7 years difference between them.
And you said that was in Canada?
Yes, that was in Alberta, Canada, where we talked about the Frank slide in Frank, Alberta, when the men were buried inside the mine. And Dad was one of 17 miners, I think, that escaped from that mine, out of probably 100.
Do you remember how long they were trapped in the mine?
No, I just recently came in possession of the book about this, and I think it's 24 hours, was it? But my dad, I understood from him that it was 3 days. But this book had been written by a man who wasn't familiar with the situation, but had gotten his information otherwise. And mother's memoirs say it was about 3 days, too. And that they did have to kill the horses that were in the mine because the horses would take up too much air.
Oh, so there were horses with them. Did they dig out eventually?
Yes. Yeah. You could read that book. Your Aunt Vivian has it. And then she loaned it to Frank John in Wyoming. He made copies. And we just received a copy from them about a week ago.
I remember reading a small booklet about it. It seems like quite a bit of the town was wiped out in the slide too, wasn't it?
That's right. The Turtle Mountain fell on top of the whole town, buried the town and the mine. And as I say, there were only the 17 men that did dig their way out, by hand.
Weren't most of the residents of the town buried too, marked by the slide?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now Frank and Carol were up to see that slide this summer on their vacation. It's quite an attraction because it's such an unusual geological event.
Oh, this is really interesting. Well, Grandma and Grandpa met in Canada. Didn't they get married over by Ravensdale?
Yes, they were married in Ravensdale, I believe in 1906. That's a year your folks were married. Oh.
So Grandpa was working over there at the time?
Yes, there was a Ravensdale mine, and he had been up into Montana fighting a fire in a coal mine in Red Lodge, Montana, just before they were married. There were lots of coal mining around then, more. But
they happened to come to Alaska then?
Well, he and mother were married, and they had two children, Vanny and Vivian. Vivian was about 4. I believe Vanny was about 9. And Dad was working in a mine around Ravensdale. And he heard about Alaska, that they were interested in coal mining there, from George Watkins Evans, now another good Welshman, and who was a state mine inspector for the state of Washington. So Dad went up in the spring of 1917 to the one mine that was in operation then. It was on the other side of Wishbone Hill. It was called the Old Doherty Mine. But the coal wasn't real good. It was kind of what you call a dirty coal. And at this time, the Alaska Railroad had been built by the federal government, since Alaska was still a territory. And the railroad ran from Seward to Anchorage to Fairbanks. And they had steam engines. And they were having to import coal from Korea and Japan on barges, which was very expensive. And they wanted to open their own coal mine in Alaska so that they would have coal for the steam engines. So So Dad heard about this, and he talked to, I think it was Colonel Mears was in charge of the railroad then and lived in Anchorage. And Colonel Mears commissioned him to open a coal mine for the Alaska Railroad at Eska. And Dad did this, and there were probably, 100 men working there. And he sent for Mother, and she and the two girls came up in the fall. Now, Eska was a very nice town with homes for the employees, and they lived there for about 4 years, and Vanny and Vivian went to school there. I think that's where they met Ora D. Clark first. I think you know Ora D. Clark, don't you, Margaret, or didn't you meet her?
I have heard you speak of her. I don't believe I've ever met her.
Well, this was a real interesting town to live in, too. There was a large community hall, and my mother and dad used to go fishing an awful lot. And there were a lot of, well, the trout fishing was just tremendous in those days. And they also had lots of dances at this community hall, and it was a fun place to live. Well, then my dad decided to open another mine. And that's when he formed the Evan Jones Coal Company with Z.J. Lusack and Oscar Anderson. I can't remember the third man that was in it. And Bob Courtney was the bookkeeper. And they opened the mine at Jonesville. And then I was born just about a year after the mine was opened. I was born in Anchorage at the old railroad hospital there. And then I was taken out to the mine, and when I was about 6 weeks old. And we lived there probably 4 or 5 years. Then the folks somehow decided to go back to the States. You know, I had to see what was out there. And of course, they missed Alaska. They were ready to come back. The lure of Alaska and black diamonds of coal inspired them to come back to Alaska. Well, this time my dad met Cap Lathrop in Seattle, and Cap owned the Healy River Mine at Sundrana, Alaska, which is probably 10 or 15 miles from Healy on the Alaska Railroad. It's more toward the Fairbanks area. And that's where my first memories actually begin, was at Healy, or at Sundrana. We had a nice house there, and Vanny and Vivian went to school in Anchorage and lived with some friends. And that was also a real interesting place, because Cap Lathrop is quite a well-known philanthropist in the Alaskan area. He had the Empress Theater in Anchorage. I think there was an Empress in Fairbanks too. And so he had a screen set up in the community hall at the mine. So we had a show once a week. That was a big event. And we had a lot of dances, and I was allowed to stay up for the dances. Oh, I was about six or seven years old. And they had a big Christmas celebration with a great big huge Christmas tree. And Santa Claus gave out these presents. I didn't find out till about 4 years later that my dad was Santa Claus, the one that gave out the presents to all these kids. And one event that stands out in my mind there is, was my mother became ill, and I felt she should go to a doctor in Fairbanks. Fairbanks was the nearest town, and there was no train coming up. That's one thing I noticed in my life in Alaska at that time. We were very dependent on the trains, on the railroad. That was the only means of transportation. But anyhow, the train on the main line went through every other day, and it just came up to the coal mine once a week. So Mother and I were loaded in John Colvin's sled. Now, John Colvin had a team of dogs, and I can remember very vividly my mother sitting in the sled with me between her knees, and we were both wrapped in bearskins because it was pretty cold, and the Healy River was completely frozen. Boy, we went down that river fast in the dog team. And John Colvin was very fond of his dogs. The lead dog was Mother. And Mother was a good lead dog, but she was getting older. And when she got tired, Mother was retired to the basket. And her daughter, Sister, took over and became the lead dog. And we went that way to Healy, and then got in the train to Fairbanks. And my mother went into the hospital there. and discovered that Mother's serious illness was a little sister that was going to be born in the spring. And we came back to St. Fran again then. And my sister was born in Fairbanks. I think that was 1928 she was born, and she was raised in St. Fran also. And Vanny and Vivian were there in the summertime. And from there we went and lived on Admiral. Well, we rented a house in Juneau, and Dad was interested in mine on Admiralty Island. That was a beautiful place. And we were there for the summer. And then we came back to Anchorage, and Mother and Dad bought the house that you know that our family lived in for the years. The house that's at the Palmer Fairgrounds now.
Where was that located again?
That was on 5th and 8th Street in Anchorage. And it's at the Palmer Fairgrounds now. It's called the Jones House.
That was right in back of the Times building, wasn't it?
Yes, it was by...
And moved by Atwater?
Bob Atwood.
Mm-hmm. Atwood?
Yes, moved it to the fairgrounds.
You know, a couple of things I had questions on. You said they went outside. Was that for a period of a couple of years?
No, I don't exactly know how long it was, but I don't think it was much more than a year.
Okay. And also, you talked about Grandpa going and opening all of these different lines. Did he decide on the locations for these? Kind of, you know, did he prospect for these, or how did they choose the locations? How did he know?
Well, Margaret, that's what has always amazed me. I mean, you've seen Wishbone Hill. It's a big hill. It's large, with trees and grass and whatnot on it. And he did prospect up there. But I think he could smell coal or something, because he knew right. He was the one that decided where to dig. And they dug the first tunnels where he said he found coal. The same thing over at Jonesville. In fact, I guess Vivian says that she moved the first shovel full of dirt for the Jonesville mine.
Oh, really?
Yes.
How many other mines did he do this at? You know, actually establish the mine?
Well, I really would have to sit down and count them, Margaret. Now, the one at Healy was already there, or the one at Centrana. Yes, there was a mine at Chickaloon, too, when he was at ESTA. He was in charge of both mines. For some reason, I think the Chickaloon mine didn't work out too much because it was very hard to transport the coal from there. That's the one deposit of anthracite coal in Alaska that I know of. But he just had a feeling for coal, Margaret. Of course, he prospected and he had his compass and all those things. But he would talk about the conglomerate and the shale and the syncline and the anticline. And he was just a smart little Welshman, I guess.
Did he establish the mine at
Eska,
or was that
Spartan? No, he established that. He opened the first mine on this side of Wishbone Hill.
Well, isn't that...
It really is.
Curious about that. Uh-huh. Very talented man.
Yes.
Well, now, they operated Jonesville once it started. They operated it... Well, and the family owned it clear through until the 50s, and it operated... Up into the 70s, didn't it?
I think it closed in 55. Now, actually, my dad sold out to his partners after he had been there about 4 years, probably in 1925 or 26. And for a long time, Oscar Anderson ran the mine. And they had a lot of trouble after that. The mine, I remember there was one fire that they had to call and ask my dad to come back and see there were a lot of men trapped inside the mine. And I remember this so vividly. I think my dad was back at Eska. It was in the winter, and he called my mother to tell her that there had been a fire at Jonesville, and they had asked him to come and try and get the men out because he knew the tunnels. And I can remember I was going to sleep and my mother walking the floor. I guess she walked the floor all night till the next morning he called and said he was safe and he had gotten the men out. It's funny the things you remember.
It is. It really is.
And That mine was operated. Now, Dad was at that mine again after I was out in the States going to school. And I think they asked him to come back and run it again because it wasn't going good or something. And then he got out of the mining business for a while, and they did move to the States. In fact, they moved to Ashland, Oregon for a while. But they went back to Alaska again. Fritz says they were there a year. Now, Dad came up. Dad was on a ship going to the Philippine Islands at that time, and he came up. He docked in San Francisco and came up to Ashland. And my sister Vivian and Walter and the children were living there, my mom and dad. And I came down from Kennewick, and we had a reunion, and my mother and dad met Fritz for the first time there. Vivian and Walter had met him in Seattle, but the rest of my family hadn't.
So they lived outside for about a year again and then had to go back, huh?
Well, that's right. You know how it is with Alaska. You don't forget it. But the mine was eventually sold to someone that did strip mining there. And I think you probably saw it as it was strip mined. And the tunnel is all closed off now. The main tunnel is cemented shut. And there was a sign up there saying that this was the site of the Evan Jones mine. And haven't you been up there? I thought you had been up there.
I have been up there twice or three times. The first time I went up, I believe, was 1969. Was quite a bit less then. Then I went up there with you one time. It must have been when I first came up, about 1978, because you showed me the house you lived in.
Oh, yes.
I went back a few years ago, and a lot of that was gone. And so I've kind of seen it in three different stages.
Oh, yes.
Did you ever go to Homer? I had heard that Grandpa mined a little bit in Homer. Were you around then, or was that later?
I was married then and was living in Kennewick. But Dad did go to Homer, and Homer is famous for having beach coal. There's actually lumps of coal they can collect on the beach. And he did open a mine there, the Homer Coal Company, and Mother and he lived down there. Now, at this time, there was only transportation was by plane, and the coal that he mined, he sold to the Homer people that lived in Homer. And that is where he died. Now, there was no hospital or doctor there, and he died in his sleep. His mother woke up and discovered Dad wasn't breathing. And she called the airlines, and they ordered a plane out to pick Dad and Mother up, and she took his body to Anchorage.
What year was that, do you know?
I know very well, because it was a few weeks after Frank John's first birthday. It was in 1950, March of 1950, he died.
Okay. I couldn't remember if it was just after I had been born. Well, I didn't know they went home then.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me look at my list of questions. Well, we said then you started out at ESCA.
Right.
Jonesville. And then you also mentioned Plantrana.
Right.
And Admiralty Island and Homer. Were there any other places that he mined?
Yes. On the other side of Wishbone from ESCA and Jonesville, there was a Pioneer Coal Company.
Houston.
And Wishbone Hill. And then at the time, just before I came out to the States to go to school, he was at Houston, which is on the railroad going toward Fairbanks. And there was a coal mine there. And that's where Colonel Olson came, I remember, and asked Dad if he would come and open up ESCA again, because the Evan Jones coal mine at that time wasn't producing enough coal. So Dad went back to ESCA, and we all did. Enjoyed living there again for a while, and then I came out to the university, and I can't remember. I guess that was probably the last mine. I think he retired from mining after that. And they came outside, and that was in Ashland, and then back again, and then they went to the Homer coal mine after the last time he came back.
Do you know if the coal, I know the coal at first was sold to the railroad, was most of the coal sold primarily to the railroad or to other, do you know where it was sold?
Yes, it was sold in Anchorage. You heated your home with coal, you cooked with coal, and Waltz Transfer delivered your coal for Walter Thielen.
You even cooked with coal?
Oh, yes. Now, it was, you know, it was pretty cold in Anchorage in the winter. We had a large coal heater in the living room, and then in the kitchen there was another coal stove that was the cook stove and also the hot water heater, because the pipes ran through the coal stove. Now, this was for most all the people that lived in Anchorage, burned coal. The only other source would have been wood. And then Fritz says that Fort Richardson burned coal too when they were first started there. Wasn't until the mining kind of petered out after the railroad switched to diesel locomotives, and I think that Fort Richardson eventually went to diesel oil too, didn't it, Frank?
That's my belief, but of course the steam trains were still running well after World War II, and they depended on coal right up until in the 50s.
Another thing I noticed about growing up in Anchorage, you were in a small town where there were no roads. Your only transportation was on the railroad. There were no roads except the one road that went around the town. And we depended a great deal on lodges and civic activities and things for our entertainment. The Elks Lodge was the site of everything in town, I think. They had all the big dances. Our high school prom was there. Our graduation was in the Elks Hall. And also the churches. There were the Presbyterian, and across from that was Episcopal, and then there was the Catholic Church. And they all provided a source of entertainment for the young people. There were clubs. The Masonic Lodge also had a lodge for young girls, you know, the Rainbow Girls, and then the Elks Lodge had the Antlers, a lodge for young boys. So we had our entertainment was a lot in one town. You didn't go visiting to another town except when they went up to Fairbanks to play basketball or to Seward or something like that.
Dad, would you check the tape? I don't know how long it is on each side.
The tape is 45 minutes on each side, Margaret. And when we near the end of this first side, I will let you know and tell you that I'm turning a tape.
Oh, you're being a responsible interviewee. That's wonderful. How many years did you actually spend at Anchorage?
We moved to Anchorage when I was about 7 years old.
From Iska.
And I went through school there and graduated from high school in 1938. I was 17 years old, and then I left for the States in the fall of 1938 to go into university.
If I may interrupt, that rather sounds like you didn't go to Anchorage until you were seven, but you were born in Anchorage, and then you lived in Eska, did you? And then moved back to Anchorage? Isn't that correct?
Well, on and off, I guess we would say. My folks did have an apartment in Anchorage at different times, but the first time they bought a house and really lived there was when I was about 7 years old, which would have been about 29.
But you still spent your summers at
the... Yes, we always spent our summers at the mine.
Well, let's see. How far did the town extend then?
Well, there was a road that we called the Loop that went around the town. Now, it was 5 miles from the edge of town to Lake Spinard. And we could walk to Otis Lake. I don't actually know what the boundaries would have been at that time. I know that...
How far were they building?
Bootleggers Cove area where the earthquake affected so much, that was land that we went out there to picnic. There were no houses or anything there at that time. And Strutz's lived probably the farthest out of town, and she is the Strutz family had a small, almost like a farm there. And this is Governor Hickel's wife, was Irma Lee Strutz. And her sister was in school with me, Kalela Strutz. But was it K Street and L Street?
Well, it wasn't more than a few blocks long and a few blocks wide, was it, Martha? I think that's what Margaret's getting at.
It was a
population of about, what, 3,000
people? 3,000 people. Mm-hmm.
Were there homes or businesses down by Ship Creek?
No. There were homes up on Government Hill, and then you walk from Government Hill over the Ship Creek Bridge to get to Anchorage, to downtown Anchorage. Actually, you came to the railroad depot first. I think the railroad depot was at the end of C Street. I think that's where it is now, too.
Did you know the Usabelli?
Well,
quite a bit later.
Yes, Emil Usabelli, the man that, of course, now his sons are run the Usabelli coal mine now, which is at Centrana, which was formerly the Healy River Coal Corporation. And Emil Usabelli worked for my dad at Jonesville. It's just rather interesting, Margaret, that Joe Usabelli stopped in at the Carter Mining Company in Gillette, Wyoming. And Frank met him, and he left kind of a newspaper explaining about the Usabelli mine, because they have really gone for sophisticated mining now. They have some large mining machines there. And Frank John sent us the newspaper clipping, which on the whole newspaper is rather a booklet. And on the back of it was given kind of a chronological order of mining in Alaska. And I sent this on to Vivian and Walter. But it did mention that Emil Usabelli came to that area to work in Jonesville. And then he later, somehow quite a lot later, I don't know the circumstances, became the owner of the Gila River mine after Cap Lathrop was killed.
Oh, I didn't know that. You know, one thing you always told me as a kid, see if I remember it right, was that Grandma always had African violets at its mine?
Well, she had African violets. The first ones I remember were geraniums. She always had geraniums in the house, too, on 5th and H Street. And at night, when it was real cold, she put up the card table by the coal stove in the living room and gathered all the geraniums from the windows and set them on the card table so they wouldn't freeze at night. And then every morning, she put them back in the windows. She also grew narcissus bulbs so that they would come out in the house in the spring, and that wonderful fragrance, you know, and there was still snow on the ground, but there was a promise of spring coming. You could smell the narcissus bulb she had raised. And my dad always had a little garden out at the mine for radishes and lettuce and onions. And he usually had a fence around this yard or this garden of birch poles. And the rabbits would get in and dig a hole in the corner and eat the produce. So my dad would stick a milk can in the rabbit hole. And the next night, the rabbit would dig another tunnel alongside. And so on it went. But we did get some lettuce and good onions and radishes out of it.
Didn't you use a mine opening for your ice box?
Yes, there were a lot of old prospecting mines around there that we did when we were out at the mine. We did use that to keep apples there, and if we wanted to make ice cream, we'd chop ice out of it, go in the tunnel a little farther and chop ice and make homemade ice cream with the ice cream freezer.
And the bears used to get in your cookhouse an awful lot, didn't they?
Yes, I'm afraid they did. And it wasn't just what they ate, it was what they destroyed. And they would go in one window and always come out another way, either a door or a window, but not the same entrance. These were, of course, little black bears, but they still could be quite destructive.
Did you have many moose in the area?
Yes. Now, there were more moose around Houston than I remember. Around Esk, I don't remember moose, but I can remember coming on a moose in the woods. I think that was around on Wishbone. And I thought it was a horse for a minute because it was so big. But I think there are more moose around there now, and they're also more belligerent. We only had trouble with the moose in the mating season in the fall. It was the only time they would bother a person, but I understand now that they're on the outskirts of Anchorage, and the people invading their territory has made them more hostile, and they will attack people easier.
Question I forgot to ask. Were they still using horses in the mines?
No, they didn't use them in the mines, but we usually had one or two horses at the mine to haul maybe logs out of the wood, to haul supplies up to the cookhouse, and there was always a horse kept there. My dad had one horse named Nellie that was at Jonesville, and he opened the mine there, and somehow later on we had Nellie at Houston. I think she was about 21 years old by then. And in the winter, Nellie got down like a horse will do who is old and sick, and she couldn't get up. And my dad had the men light bonfires around Nellie, and one man to stay out there all night long and keep the fires going so Nellie wouldn't get cold. And after, I guess, about 3 or 4 days, old Nellie got up again and watched. But my dad was very... I had a lot of affection for animals, I guess you might say.
Did you want to take a little break, have a drink or something?
Yes, I do have a glass of water here.
Oh, good. this is just fascinating. It really is. A lot of this I don't remember hearing. I may have been too young or forgotten, and it's just really so interesting. One thing I was curious about is, did the depression affect your family, or did it seem to affect the area of Alaska?
Well, I wasn't very really conscious of the depression. I heard about it, but it didn't affect Anchorage too much because you had to have so much money to get to Anchorage to pay your steamship fare and rail fare and all to get up there. And yet we had a tape, an audio or a video tape from Walt and Vivian the other day, and Walt mentioned that during the Depression, he lost his job at the Alaska Railroad. He was working in the storage department then at the Alaska Railroad. So the Depression must have affected us to some degree, but of course I would have been only about 8 years old and I wasn't too aware of it. My dad and your father is very much more aware of the Depression because of the people that rode the rails, I guess, in the soup kitchens. He can probably tell you more about that.
Well, remember when the Nisqually Valley colonists come through? Were you there, or had you already gone outside to school?
No, we were there. I was there, and we were in Anchorage. This must have been in high school. In fact, I think they came up about 1935, because I've always told you how we walked so much, Margaret. Now, we walked, the whole school walked down to meet the colonists. No, I don't think we were in school. I'm not sure if we were in school or not, but the whole student body walked to meet the colonists, and the town put a big dinner on for them, and the Rainbow Girls were the waitresses at the dinner. And so we got to meet the colonists and welcome them. I think they were only in town for a couple of hours, and they were taken on up to the Matanuska Valley. But another time we walked the whole school down to the railroad is when Will Rogers and Wiley Post were killed in an airplane accident around Point Barrow. You probably have heard of Will Rogers. And his body was flown to Fairbanks, and then the two bodies were on the train, came through Anchorage, and the school closed, and all the children were walked down to the railroad depot to kind of salute Will Rogers, his memory.
Well, a couple more things about the colonists. How did, or I don't know if you were aware of it at the time or remember, but how did Alaskans or the Alaskans you know feel about the colonists coming? Were they excited? Did they think it was stupid? Did they think, or what did they think? Do you remember?
Well, I think we were all kind of thrilled and happy for these people, and we always thought the Matanuska Valley was a beautiful place. And also, we were looking toward getting more fresh produce and potatoes and cabbage and all these things that the colonists expected to grow. And of course, the colonists had to live in tents when they first came until houses were built for them. And some of them got disillusioned and went back. But lots of them have stayed on, of course, as you probably met some of them around Wasilla.
Well, Rod Cottle's parents were colonists, Margaret.
Oh, I didn't know they were. Oh, well, that's interesting. Did Palmer or Wasilla exist very much then, or were they more just stops on the railroad?
Wasilla was an important stop on the railroad. They had a large railroad depot there. And Matanuska was a fairly large place. Palmer wasn't too large. It was more just a stop-off place. But of course it became more important due to the movement of the colonists in. These people came from the interior of the United States, as I remember. They were people from Nebraska, Minnesota, and that area who had gone through the Dust Bowl, lots of them, the Depression too, and lost their farms. And they were paid a certain amount of money to homestead in Alaska. And then the government agreed to support them for so long.
I want to warn you, I'm going to have to turn this tape in just a moment, but just go ahead and I'll just say, this is the end of tape, side one. So go ahead.
Well, by the time I was ready to graduate from high school, I think there was one road that went from Anchorage up to Wasilla. And because I remember on our senior sneak, we did drive up to this road and toward the Independence Mine. And but that is the only road. There was no road to Seward or anything, or Fairbanks, of course, at that time, just the railroad.
Let's see, when did you go outside?
My first trip out was in 1930. Well, now the first one I remember was in 38. I probably went out as a child. I think probably twice, but I don't remember those at all.
I'm sorry, this is the end of side one. I'm going to have to stop this and turn the tape to side two. This is tape two, the start of tape one, pardon me, the start of side two. Go ahead, Margaret. Mara.
Well, Margaret, I wanted to tell you about my mother and dad and the two older girls. First Thanksgiving, this was before Margaret and I were born, of course, but they arrived in Anchorage, probably in September, I think it was, or October, and went out to a home in Eska. They were there for Thanksgiving, and my mother had ordered a turkey. And the railroad, the train didn't get through. I think there was a snowstorm or something. And all they had a ham, a big ham. So Mother fixed ham and beans for their first Thanksgiving in Alaska. But one thing was interesting to me, too. Now, the Alaska Steamship Company was the only way of getting to Alaska then. There were no planes that flew from Seattle to any place in Alaska. But you went on the Alaska Steamship Company. And after I had been through, when I was, I was finished nurse's training in Seattle. And the war, of course, had started at this time, and I wanted to make a trip home. I hadn't seen my folks. It was very difficult. I could not get any passage. They wouldn't allow any civilians, only military or army or navy. Well, finally, a friend of mine suggested that I might be able to get on a relief trip as a stewardess. And the stewardesses on those at that time on each boat had to be a registered nurse. So I did find out a registered nurse that did want a trip off. And I had to get a Coast Guard permit. I had to get a union permit. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, I appeared at the SS Denali to go to Anchorage or Seward and to discover that the Army had taken over the ship. And instead of civilians, we were taking 400 Army personnel to Seward. It was a little different trip. But anyhow, after we docked in Seward, I tried to get a plane from Seward to Anchorage, and I was talking to my folks, and I said, our ship leaves tomorrow, and the operator interrupted, do not give out any information on ships coming or going. And, you know, you really almost forgot there was a war on, but it was, and it was, they were very careful in Alaska. All the portholes on the ship were painted black. But anyhow, the first mate got a ride for me with in a small plane, and I think it was Noel Ween that was the pilot, and he already had a passenger, a young soldier, but the soldier said he would ride on the baggage just behind the seat so I could sit with Noel Ween and go over to Anchorage. So I was over there for one day with my family, and then I came back next day and came back as stewardess on the steamship again.
You only visited for one day?
Yes. Well,
oh
yes.
My gosh, I didn't know that.
My goodness.
I knew you had come up, but I didn't know it was just for one day. Well, that is really something.
Well, that was just, you know, just to see my folks. And then in 1944, after Dad and I were engaged, my sister was to be married in Anchorage and asked me to come up and be her bridesmaid. So they did have some airplane transportation, and I flew Pan American from Seattle to Juneau, and then we stayed overnight in Juneau, and then flew Alaska Airlines to Anchorage. And then I got stuck in Anchorage. I couldn't get out again, because this was 1944, in the middle of the war, and it was the same thing. No military, only no civilian transportation, only military. But my dad did finally get a passage for me on a steamship, and it turned out to be the Denali again, the ship that I had come up on before, so I knew an awful lot of the crew members. And it was an interesting trip back. Besides, Dad was waiting in Seattle for me.
Well, tell me a story about, have you and Dad almost lived next door to each other?
Oh, I'm going to let Dad tell that one, because that was really surprising.
Well, do you want me to go ahead with that?
Yeah,
you can. All right. Well, my dad decided to move the family to Alaska. It was in either 1928 or 29. I believe it was 1929, though, Margaret. And he accepted a job with the Anchorage Drug Company in Anchorage. And the man who owned it was Mr. McCormick, who owned the Alaska Steamship Line. So Dad went to Alaska, to Anchorage, Alaska, and took over this drugstore from Mr. McCormick. And we, in turn, moved in from Spanaway. We were living at Spanaway Lake into Tacoma in preparation of moving to Alaska. And my mother had sold everything that we didn't need, you know, and given things away to other relatives and whatnot. But we received a cablegram. It was in the fall, of not to come, because my dad had hurt himself and was in the hospital in Anchorage. He had shattered his ankle, and he was going up the stairs in the old drugstore, and someone had dropped a pencil on the stair. The staircases were open, and his toe caught under the step above, and he fell backwards and just shattered his ankle. And they operated on him in Anchorage, but it wouldn't heal. But he had, in the meantime, rented a house, which was just two doors away from where Martha and her family lived. It was there right behind the Times building in what is now a parking lot. And he had rented this house, and we would have been neighbors, but Dad wired us not to come. He had sent us the steamship tickets, and we were to go on as soon as we could to join him up there. So later on, Martha and I met at the university in Seattle, but but when I took Martha home to meet my folks, my dad remembered her. She used to, in 1929, come into the drugstore with her friends.
My dad.
That's my dad used to remembered her, and remembered Mom's family. So we almost became neighbors, you see. But then Dad had to come back to the States because his ankle wouldn't heal in Alaska. And this must have been 28 that he went up there, because I think he was there during the crash in 1929. He came back, he couldn't work for a long time because he couldn't walk. His ankle was so bad. But he went up on a boat, this may interest you, that was the flagship for the Alaska Steamship Line. It was called the Aleutian. And he got off the boat, or the ship, in Seward, and that in the daytime, and the boat went on to a cannery somewhere beyond Seward, hit a uncharted rock and sunk in a matter of just a couple, 3 minutes. And he had just gotten off the boat. And of course, we read about this in the newspaper in Tacoma the next day, and my mother was quite excited, wondering if Dad had gone down with it. But see, there was no telephone communications between Alaska and the lower 48 then, but they could send a cable or a radiogram somehow. And Dad sent a radiogram that he was all right, that he'd gotten off the ship just before it had sunk. Well, that's the story there, if you want to go on with Mark now.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, Mom, I'm almost done. I have just a couple more questions for you. I wonder if you, I believe that the Taylans and also Aunt Viv and Aunt Fanny also married longtime Alaskans. I wonder if you could tell me just very briefly who they married and what their backgrounds were, and what they did in the early part of their lives as young married couples, because I know they were really part of Alaska history. And do this with the thought that I really should conduct an interview with each of them, I realize it, but I had heard something about, Aunt Nanny's first husband's father went over the Chilkoot Trail or something like that. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Well, yes, I do, and this was Bob Courtney that was the bookkeeper for the first Evan Jones Coal Company, was Ralph's father. So Ralph and Vanny actually knew each other when they were probably, 10 or 12 years old at Jonesville. But his father had come over the trail. Now, the story that I have heard is that he and another man brought a load of pigs over the trail to sell to the miners. And when they came to Lake Bennett, now at the end of the trail, they had to cross this lake, and they built a barge to carry the pigs, and the barge sank and they lost all their pigs. But young Ralph did climb the Chilkoot Trail probably 10 or 15 years ago to be like his, to follow the same path that his grandfather had taken. One part that was rather bad about this, Bob Courtney kept a diary of this trip, but he kept it in shorthand because he was an accountant, so not everyone can read that story, but that is right. And Vanny and Ralph were married in Anchorage. Vanny was teaching school there, and she taught fifth grade in the Anchorage schools, and she and Ralph were married. Of course, married women couldn't teach, so she didn't teach school anymore. And later, a couple of years after that, they went to, he worked for the NC company, and they went into Tekotna first. And they were at, ran the NC trading post and store at Tekotna. And from there, they were transferred to the NC store in McGrath and ran that store for a good number of years. And they finally decided to come back to Anchorage, though, because they got a little tired of living out in the bush because they wanted to raise a family. So they came back to Anchorage, and Ralph worked for the Star Airlines until he developed what is known as Addison's disease. It's a disease of the adrenal glands. At that time, there was no cure for it. Now, nowadays, they can not cure it, but it's treated with the adrenal cortex hormones. And Ralph did have some kind of shots he had to take, because he came out to the Virginia, no, it wasn't Virginia Mason, it was the one in Rochester, Minnesota. He went back to the
Mayo
brothers there. And he was on some kind of an adrenal hormone, because I taught Danny how to give the injections to him. And he lived probably maybe 5 years after that and then died. And then...
What year?
I don't exactly know.
About 1949, I think it was.
Let's see. I think that's right. Probably was about 49, because he was alive in 44, I know. But then Vanny had to support herself and the children, and she went back to school teaching, and she taught at Healy on the Alaska Railroad, and that's where she met Larry, who worked for the railroad. I think he was car inspector or something. And she married Larry Davenport, I believe it was just the day before Christmas. And all the little Thielens said, Vanny got a new Davenport for Christmas. That was kind of cute.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, Aunt Betty got a new Davenport. And they, of course, were married. I think your Uncle Larry probably died in about 1970 something, wouldn't have been, Fritz? 72 probably. I think it was maybe 72 or 74.
Around 74, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. And the Vanny kept working. By then she was in charge of this, she was working at the Bank of Alaska, and then she was in charge of the Heritage Museum there for a long time. I think you visited her at the museum probably.
Yes, I did. Just one point I want to clarify then. So Ralph's father did go over the
Tilkoot
Trail. Do you know if he mined and then he stayed in Alaska, or do you know what that was?
Well, he stayed in Alaska. He came to Anchorage. He was an accountant, and he set up his own accounting office there. I believe his wife and they had two other children were there for a while, and then they separated. And I knew his wife and his other, Bob Courtney's other daughter in Seattle.
Okay, what about the
Thielens
then? Do you know about Uncle Walt's father?
Yes, Uncle Walt's father came to Alaska, and I can't tell you right the date, but Uncle Walt is 84 years old, so you can figure out when he was born. He was 84 years old last March, and he was born in Clary Creek near Fairbanks. But he was brought up in Ruby, which is on the Yukon River. And his father was a blacksmith, I believe. His name was John Thielen. And he met Mrs. Thielen in Seattle. They were married there, and then he took her up to Alaska. He was, he would have been Norwegian, and she was Irish. They had a large family, I think, 5 children probably, and when they lived on this Yukon River, it's just something to me that seemed almost an impossibility, but Vivian got hold of the newspaper that was printed at this time, and it's just a small newspaper story made up in Ruby, Alaska, and it said John Thielen found a well-preserved mastodon or mammoth while he was plaster mining on the Yukon River, and he had sold the jeweler in Ruby, had bought the tusks from the mastodon for the ivory, and they had cut up the meat and sold it to be food for the dog team dogs. I have that paper, and someday I'll give it to you, Margaret. I think that's something you should be passed on. I mean, if that happened now, there'd be a whole trio of scientists from the University of Alaska going up to inspect this well-preserved mammoth.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah, definitely. It would be a big deal. It's for him that was dog food.
Yeah. And I think Walter now was on his own by the time he was 16. He was supporting himself. He had sometime worked as a mechanic on the railroad. And then he had worked in the storage department on the railroad. When he and Vivian were married, he had started Walt's Transfer, and they were very active in Walt's Transfer for years. And
within Anchorage?
In Anchorage, yes. And actually, when they sold Walt's Transfer, I can't remember the name of the man that bought it, but he has, as the head of the Anchorage Refuse Company, his sons are running it now. It's an Irish name. But it developed into a very big project. You know, the Anchorage Refuse Company now has a lot of money behind it.
That's what it developed?
Yes. Tom Culhane. Tom Culhane's son was a pilot, and I think that Tom Culhane's son and his grandson were killed probably in the last year or two in an airplane crash around somewhere near Anchorage. Vivian had written to me about this, because they remained friends over the years. And Walter worked in Seward, too, at one time. But
when they moved to Wasilla?
Let's see now. Walter went back to the railroad and worked again when the children were born in Anchorage. And then they bought a grocery store up toward D Street. It was called Lucky Baldwin's Grocery. And they bought it and ran it and discovered, after they had it for a year, that Walter had tuberculosis. And now that's something, too, out of the 100 students in high school that I went to, I would say at least 10 of them died of tuberculosis at this time. There was no cure for it, like there is now. But anyhow, Vivian and Walter came out to California, and Walter was in a tuberculosis sanitarium for a year. They advised him not to go back to Alaska, and that's how they settled in Ashland. But of course, they were, you know, could never forget Alaska, and so after a year, they went back to Alaska. And I think Walter worked for the railroad for a while, but that's when they bought Herning's store at Wasilla for Mr. and Mrs. Herning. And they had that store, I think, 25 years in about 1965, it seems to me. I'm trying to think when they did buy it, because it was after, of course.
40 makes sense then?
Would have been after 40.
It would have been about 1946 they
about
bought
1946,
it.
About 1946, Dad says,
probably. And they sold it in just before 1970.
Yes.
About 1975 is when they sold it.
65.
No, it'd be 75. They still owned it when we lived out of Green Oaks.
Yeah,
because
I went up in 69 and they were, you know, they still had
it. Yeah, it was about
75. I think it was 72 when Carol Franklin married. I think it's when they sold it that year.
Well, Mom, I've exhausted my questions, but if you have more to tell me, keep going.
Oh, I don't know. One thing I think I probably told you that, you know, our family always did a lot of singing. And that, of course, was because it was a small town. But out at the mine in the summer, we would walk the railroad track. It's another way we were connected
go
with the railroad.
I got to go let the dog in.
Because there were no roads to walk. But we would sing as we walked the railroad and to scare the bears away. And also, we would go berry picking a lot of wild raspberries and blueberries and currants. And we would take a can with rocks in it and rattle that can to scare the bears away, because if you were going to find a bear, it was very often in the berry patch or crossing the railroad. But we always enjoyed singing. I learned songs from World War I because my mother would sing these old songs. It was interesting, you know. I know you've always said I enjoyed walking, and I think that's probably the reason, because they walked so much. I asked Walter, I said, well, why did so many people put their cars up in the winter, not run them in the winter? She said, because there wasn't any antifreeze to put in your radiator. The people that did run, they had to drain the radiator at night. And then sometimes they used rubbing alcohol to fill the car with that. That was pretty expensive. But I didn't realize they didn't have antifreeze in those days. So that was one reason that so many people walked. Well, that's about all I can think of, unless you have any specific questions. Of course, there was a lot of ice skating and sleigh riding and cross-country skiing in Anchorage. That was a lot of fun. We were growing up.
Why don't you drop some names? Let you be a name dropper and drop some names of people who are famous. Did you know Irma Lee Hickel's sister?
Yes. she's Emily Pickle now. I knew her sister, Clell Strutz. And you know Mulcahy Park, you know, Alice Mulcahy and I were in school together. Her dad was some kind of an official on the railroad, I don't remember what. And of course, Pat James, that had the Cobuk Coffee Shop in Anchorage for so many years. She and I were editor and co-editor on the high school annual, the Anchor. And in fact, I received a letter not long ago. They're having a big reunion for the class of 1942 and all classes of Anchorage High School that graduated before 1955. They're having a reunion in June, I think it is, in Anchorage. And one of the highlights is a picnic at the Hickel residence, I guess.
Oh.
So it should be fun.
So you graduated in 1938?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm the same year. And let's see, who else did I know? Well, I knew Johnny Johnson that has the accounting service in Anchorage. And,
You said Mr. Lusak was an investor in Dad's mine?
Yes.
And the Oscar Anderson?
Yes, Oscar was a, owned a meat market, and Z.J. Lusak, of course, was a pharmacist and owned Lusak's pharmacy. And I'm sure there was a third man, but I just can't remember who it was.
Yeah, I can't remember who that would be. Seeing the name, there's a plaque at the Oscar Anderson house. Nancy found this, but I can't think of what the third man's name was. And you knew Ray Peterson, the
yes,
one of the founders of Weenie, his wife?
Yes, his wife was Tony Shoddy, I think. It was Tony married Ray Peterson.
How about
Sonny was their child.
The fellow that owns the
Gottstein?
Gottstein, yeah.
Yeah.
And the fellow that worked for Gottstein that I knew
Johnny.
Something. I can't think of his name now. Mm-hmm. But he said his folks had a dairy farm.
Oh, there was a doctor there. There was only one dairy farm in town when I lived there, Old's Dairy, and then Asa Martin's father opened a dairy there, and Asa Martin became a doctor in Anchorage later on. He went to medical school and whatnot.
I have heard. Well, Mom, this was just fascinating. I can't wait to type it up and send it to you. It's just fascinating.
Well, I'm glad you're interested. Oh, and there was one radio station in Anchorage, station KFQD. It's still there, and it used to be only operated in the evenings, but now it's a full-time radio station.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that was the only station that we could get on the radio at night. And your Uncle Walt read the news on that for a long time. In the evening. And your Uncle Walt was a volunteer fireman, so we always knew where all the fires were. And I stayed with Vivian Water because the telephone operator would call the volunteer firemen and tell them where the fire was, where to go. And it was just, you know, an interesting small town.
Now, Merrifield wasn't there. It was started while you were there, probably in the 30s, do you think?
Yes.
Wasn't that the main airport?
Yes, it was a main airport. Now, I knew Merrill, and they had two young boys. I remember he and his wife. And the Merrill Field was named after him. He was a bush pilot, too.
I know you've got some really neat pictures of Merrill Field in there.
Yes.
Oh, that is great. Well, thank you very much. I can't tell you how much I thank you. Alaskan history is so interesting to me. And also family history. It's just so neat when I come.
Well, that's really interesting, Margaret. You know, Evan Jones's mother's name was Margaret.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that's one reason you're named Margaret.
And my grandmother, great-grandmother Rannis was Marguerite.
Hey.
Yes.
I come from a long line of Margaret.
Yeah, it looks like you do.
One other thing, that person who is employing me,